and welcome to All Tomorrow's Festivals, a content series exploring the future of the arts, entertainment and culture through the early signals that are emerging this year at the festivals in August in Edinburgh, all the various different festivals that are there, although this time we're talking to artists in the Fringe Festival. I'm Nick Sherrard. I'm MD at Label Sessions and also a slightly reluctant futurist, and I'm joined by our content producer, Joss Nixon.
Hello.
So the show we're talking about today is called Trouble, Struggle, Bubble and Squeak. The interview is with Victoria Melody, who the show is created by. It's kind of about a hell of a story in her life. It involves the first reference to historical reenactment societies in any of our interviews so far. But yeah, it's a really interesting show. So it's all about her story, how she got involved with historical reenactment societies, the diggers and rebellion and searching for a different way of living, the link between that and maybe the modern day diggers in a council estate in Brighton, telling a whole story a different way. There's so many different things that are involved in this story. It's almost felt like an interview where I was trying to make sure that we kind of got through all of it in the interview as we're going through the questions, but whether it's like an onion or something, you can peel one thing and there's something else really interesting that's underneath. It's really hard to talk about because you always feel like you're leaving out something important.
Yeah. And one of my favorite bits was she was talking about how, you know, it came through from a place of personal turmoil, which is a terrible thing, but how she came to find it by searching on Google the term world turned upside down, and that's how this sort of came to be, and how such a simple thing can lead to, you know, that onion situation.
Well, yeah, so you will hear that expressed for you. Yeah. So I guess this is maybe it's an incredible show that it, to some extent, starts out from a Google search.
Yeah.
So any of us who have ever gone down kind of weird loop of searching around all the different things that are around a Google search, it's a good example of it. Although it doesn't really, because actually Victoria's story is incredible in terms of starting out as an anthropologist, going and being with all kinds of people and then turning those into creative outputs. This time it being a live show, which seems really natural to this whole story, but interesting. And interesting also, one of the surprises for me, because I saw the blurb when we were sending the information about this show, and we were kind of selected who, you know, the most interesting shows we wanted to talk to. I was thinking, one, it's really interesting, this whole historical reenactment thing. It's an interesting story there. But also, it's directed by Mark Thomas, who is very well known to comedy audiences, and in particular to audiences in the Edinburgh festivals, but also known as somebody who makes TV shows. And knowing a bit about Victoria's work in the past as well, so it also involves lots of film.
Yeah.
It's almost as if, you know, now lots of shows you see involve film, but this one doesn't actually. Yeah. They've actually tried to tell the story a different way, so it doesn't involve film. I thought it was a really interesting kind of creative choice and a bit of a surprise considering what I was expecting.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get into the mechanics of it. So it's 2:15 every day at the Pleasance Courtyard above, and the above, I was under the names of the Pleasance Courtyard hard to talk about, but it's in the Pleasance Courtyard. It's in the room it's called above. 2:15 every day. Let's dive into it. It's a really interesting story. There's so many interesting bits as we go through. At the end, we're going to just come back. And it's the only sort of, 20 minutes of life that are going to involve references to some really kind of socially awkward interactions in a historical reenactment society in Northumberland, Brighton, and also the practical applications of AI.
Yeah.
So let's head into it. Bic, what can audiences expect when they come to your show this year?
Oh, straight in there.
Yes, that was.
Straight in there. This is a brand new show, and so it's interesting me and learning how to talk about it. This is the first time I'm talking about it because it's fresh out of the oven. It's the first time that me and comedian and theatre maker Mark Thomas have worked together. He's the director, I'm the performer, the creator, not of the world, I'm not God, obviously, just the show. But yeah, it's the first time that we've ever collaborated together, and we're both mischievous. we both go out in the world and we do something for real. And then the show is sort of partly reporting on that. It's not just the show. There's a bigger project attached to it. And so what will people get? They will get storytelling, stand-up comedy, and a stunning story about a genuine community that is based it's based on a council estate in East Brighton. It's all true, but it's a universal tale. It's about people who take things into their own hands when the state fails them. It's about people who take action to help their community.
And how did it start? How did this one, where did the sort of start of this idea come from?
Oh my goodness. First of all, oh my goodness. How long do you want these questions to be?
As long as you feel you need to be them. Although I'm not really aware that your voice is going from earlier, so I feel like we have to.
Oh, it's fine. I can waft on. So basically, it all started because I'm an anthropologist, and so I embed myself into Britain's niche communities. And so in the past, I've become a pigeon fancier. I learned how to raise pigeons. I have been a Northern soul dancer, a championship dog show handler. I got to Crofts with my Basset Hound, Major Tom. I've been a beauty queen. I was Mrs. Brighton in 2011, 2012. I've been a funeral director. And so that's what I do. I embed myself into Britain's hobbyists and enthusiasts. And then I make shows about that world and how it's changed me. And I normally embed myself for a really long time, between 3 and 4 years. And so there's a lot of material that I've collected in that time and a lot of real conversations. And I've met a lot of incredible characters. And so for this, but it's always random how I end up embedding myself with these communities. I don't just go, oh, I'm going to be a Morris dancer. It somehow just falls in my path. And I love going with the sort of spontaneous, random things that are thrown at me. I kind of accept that and go, okay, this is where we're going next. And so I was getting divorced and I was quite sad about it, and I typed in world turned upside down into Google, just, I don't know, for a remedy for heartache. And I found this history book by a man called Christopher Hill. And it talked about the radical groups in the English Revolution. And then I just went down this massive wormhole where I found out all about these 17th century activists called the Diggers. So in a way, it was a remedy for heartache because I was completely distracted by this new group. And then that was the group I wanted to embed myself with. But there's an issue, because that was in the 17th century and they're all dead now. And so I thought, what's the next best thing? Oh, I know, I'll join a historical reenactment society. And so I joined a historical reenactment society and looking for diggers. And the reason why I love the Diggers so much is because in 1649, faced with poverty, inflation and unemployment, sound familiar, even though it was 375 years ago, the Diggers just took it upon themselves to occupy common land, to grow crops, to feed themselves. And it was part peaceful protest, and it was need as well. And so I became really interested in these people who take action to, when they're failed. And I went looking for diggers in the reenactment society, and I became a musketeer. I'm a musketeer. I'm a musketeer boy. And but then I quickly found out there were no diggers. But now I was sort of so stuck in to the group, and I'd made friends with everyone, and they'd given me a beautiful uniform that was hand-stitched, and they'd made me meals, and they helped me buy a little camper van so that I could camp well. I just get really involved, and I felt like I couldn't leave. And then around the same time, I was chosen to be an artist in residence in East Brighton. Usually artists apply and then a panel of locals choose somebody, but the panel requested, the local panel, East Brighton, it's White Hawk in East Brighton, it's a council estate, and the local panel chose me. They asked me, they invited me to come do the residency, and I just felt, wow, I've always had to fight to be an artist, to be a creative. So for something to be given to me, this is really special. And then I started working out in East Brighton, and the idea was that we create a big art project together. So I just hung around like I always do, went to everything. And then I found out that the Diggers weren't in the past, they're in the present. So I couldn't find them in the Reenactment Society. I found them right here on this estate, the people that were squatting kitchens in order to feed people during lockdown, the people who were stopping developers from developing industrial units on some of the only green space in the area, the people who set up a youth centre after a kid was murdered and other kids witnessed the murder and didn't feel safe and had nowhere to grieve. And so I was just really struck. I had a sort of light bulb moment that, okay, I have found the Diggers. They're right here.
Okay. What a story. I mean, also, one of the things that's really interesting in that is, was it always really natural that was going to turn into a performance piece as well, and a live performance piece, right? Because anthropologists write books, right? And quite often that kind of embedded storytelling turns into a documentary or something. Was it always going to be a live performance in your mind?
I didn't know what this was going to be. And my projects don't always end up a theatre show. I studied fine art in Newcastle. And so the project determines the outcome. So I didn't know that this was going to be a show, but also it's not just a show, it's part of a larger project. So we actually, the community and I, in the way, same way that the Diggers did it, we took a bit of land without permission, and we started a community garden to grow vegetables especially with young people, and those vegetables go to a free lunch club. And retrospectively, we've been given a 25-year lease on that. So that's also part of this, you know. Yeah. It's not just the show.
Yeah. Yeah, the sort of, well, actual land is involved. That's like, there's a lot of people in this series who are saying like something slightly bigger than just the show is involved, but you're actually like, there's a real manifest thing. There's a real change in the world. Isn't
there? Yeah, there is. And I'm one of the co-signatories, so I can't even walk away from it. It's proper embedded work.
Yeah, okay.
They're stuck with me.
So then we come into August of 2025 and you're bringing it to the Edinburgh Festival. We're asking everyone this, kind of like, why now and why here? So why come to Edinburgh this summer?
Well, so I haven't been for a few years. The last time I came, I hadn't made a show for a really long time. And so I wanted to kind of relaunch myself and to remind the world that, hiya, I'm still here. And that was with my show Headset. And it did really well. And we got a tour out of it afterwards. I really enjoyed going out touring. And this time, I just feel like the story is very urgent. And I feel, and I was thinking about this earlier, that I have never cared so much about something before. I mean, obviously, I've crafted art and I've loved it and I want it to do really well. But actually, this one, This is a story that needs to be told. People are hungry right here, right now. And being an anthropologist and observing and taking notes and recording it, it's not enough. This one, you know, there needs to be, there needs to have change happen. But also, it's a really hopeful show. There's so much going on in the world that we're not in control of, but we are in control with finding out what the grassroots, you know, organizations that are happening in our local community. What's already going on that we can get involved with? And everyone who's been to see the show so far, not everyone, I didn't speak to everyone, but a lot of people said, how do I get involved with my local community? Mm-hmm. And so that for me is a brilliant call to action that, yeah, we can't, you know, it's hard for us to individually stop Donald Trump, but we can go and offer to do a few hours driving for a Community Meals on Wheels charity.
Right. Okay. Is that kind of your hope of how people respond as well? Is that kind of your sort of sense of, you know, would that would put a swing in your step if people are walking out thinking, I'm going to go and do something?
Yeah, it's rousing. Rousing. And so it's like, oh, why is this happening? But also, we can do something.
And then it's such a massive story. So like the whole story is so fascinating. I know we've only scratched the surface of it in this conversation, but there's also an interesting moment now when you come to presenting an hour in a thing like a festival like the Fringe, when there's all that mechanics and there's so many choices around like what you can say and making the journey of the hour work and working with a director. Like, does that feel a really natural thing, or does that feel quite unnatural in a way? You're kind of having to take this massive story and turn it into an hour that people will walk into and then walk into another show afterwards as well. Like, how do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I am definitely one for generating too much material. I'm a massive documenter, and I love an anecdote. And so this show, I mean, the Pigeon Fanciers, I started working with those 17 years ago, and I'm still involved. And so so I'm still collecting stories, even though there is no kind of show for that. But with this, it was my first time working with Mark Thomas, and he said, if we're going to work together, I want you to do something different than you've ever done before. And so he set some rules in place, and one of those rules was no film. I've always had film in my shows, and that had an important role. It beds what I do in truth. So then you believe it. You believe that I walked down a catwalk at Mrs. Universe and my dog got to Crufts because you see it. It also helps the audience to visualize the characters, and it kind of it grounds them in the places that I'm talking about. So without film, my writing has had to go up a notch, and I have to really describe and help the audience to imagine where I am. We've had to find ways with the set to show that it's embedded in truth. And my performance has had to get. I have to perform really well in this show. I have to play some of the characters, and I'm not an actor, and I was really worried about that. And then Mark said, when you talk about the characters and you discuss the conversations that you had, you naturally take on their persona. So you've just got to remember those conversations and sort of ease into their essence, you know. And so I'm playing those people, and they've been to see it. The community have been very involved in the making of this show.
Yeah.
From we staged a big historical reenactment in White Hawk, and they all dressed up and were involved in that. They've been to the read-throughs. They've challenged me. They've helped me. They've helped me make the set. The kids from the area have done the soundtrack. So they've been, everyone's helped make it. So how do I do that all in an hour? Well, I normally take years and years and years to make a show, as I embed myself in the community for 4 years. And this time Mark was like, no, we're not going to lose momentum. We're just going to write it and work and work. And so we've just wrangled it into a form. And he could see me sort of veering off. Oh, I'm just going to go over here and do this. He's like, no, stay on track. And so we've worked more efficiently than I've ever worked before. Because I'm a theatre maker. He's a comedian. Comedians make shows every year. So he's helped me be efficient.
Oh, really? Okay, it's interesting. It's interesting the kind of removal of film, because one, looking back, one of you've done that so much, and Mark's well known for making TV, right? It's kind of, it's interesting that you actually think you sort of, it's more honest in a way if it's just within the room or something. Is it like,
yeah,
works?
Yeah, it's just a, it's a very, how do we call it? Like, it's just a very pure, honest, stripped back, beautiful story in its essence,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that relies on good performance. So, so it has put, it's pushed me, which is good, and it's exactly what you want from a director. We joke and we say that he's like the ballet teacher from Fame with the stick. It's like, do it again, do it again. It's not good enough. Higher plié.
That's an image. That's good. So we're only a couple of weeks away now, right? So as you're thinking about coming out for August, I mean, are there things that you are excited about? How does it feel?
Oh, it's because I've done everything so quickly. It's taken me 2 years to make a show rather than 4 years. So this is like radically fast for me. And also because I got divorced. And so that's like a big life changing, moving, all of that, trying to earn money, because let's face it, you don't earn that much money in the arts. Mm-hmm. I have just been on this really fast conveyor belt of producing the show, life, admin things. And so what I'm looking forward to when I get to Edinburgh is to find out what else is on, go and see stuff. There's nothing I can do at home. You know, I can't go and work in the community garden because I'm not there. I can't, I don't know, help if a roof comes off, a tile comes off the roof. I am basically in Edinburgh for art and art only. We're talking to some organizations up there who are the equivalent of the Community Meals on Wheels charity in Brighton and land activists and youth center workers. So I'll be doing some work with them as well. So there'll be some surrounding myself by wonderful modern day diggers, and they'll be surrounding myself in art and absorbing that, hopefully, like a sponge.
Okay. And then sort of related question to that, when you look around the sort of creative world, the arts world just now, are there things you feel positive about, and are there also other things that you feel sort of scared of or need to be wary of just now?
I'm really scared that we're only going to be hearing from rich people on stages, and people aren't going to see themselves represented on stage anymore. I'm really scared of that happening. To make this show has been so difficult. The fees that I get for touring now are less than what I was getting 15 years ago. Obviously, Creative Scotland and Arts Council, there's less money to make work, to take risks. I just felt really strongly that this story needed to be told, and I felt that I would be letting down the community that I'd been working with if I didn't make this show. And they're so proud of it, and I'm so proud of it, you know, that I've had to sort of invest my own money into it. And that is such a risk. You know, if we don't make money, then I personally go into debt. So, you know, there's just so much risk with the artists. Either they don't, you know, you invest your own money and risk going into debt, you know, or, yeah, you're not old enough to get a bank loan. Yeah.
That is a theme we picked up a bit in this a lot. I think there's a real sense that maybe it's getting harder for people who aren't independently wealthy to be putting shows on stage, in particular through the big festivals like Edinburgh. It does seem like it's getting harder. It's
an
experience too. Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, it is. It's risky. It's really risky business. So I worry about that. I think AI is quite interesting. I don't know if you've had much conversations about that, and I don't know if that's relevant to this, but
it's really interesting because some people haven't wanted to talk about it at all. But it's
I think it might help us, because it the AI can help with all the crap things that we're bad at, you know, like writing a letter to the solicitor, helping with accounts. What's happening for me is that AI is helping me to do all the things I'm really bad at, to leave me more time to be creative. And I do wonder in the future, because, you know, for example, like a structural engineer has always been much more valued or an architect than an artist. Well, those jobs might go to AI, but live performers, that's going to be really hard to replicate them at the moment. So I think things might get good for us.
Yeah, yeah. No. Sort of open things up a bit because it allows you sort of the tools to do things with fewer resources.
I'll be coming onto stage with my Zimmer frame going, this is my time. Finally.
That's really interesting. And then one other thing I wanted to pick up as well, but in this particular show, which is an interesting thing, which is, you know, it's clearly, it's really interesting here. You talk about how rousing it is, but it's work that's about big issues and about things. And it's also about heritage. And heritage used to be a thing that was kind of, I think a lot of people associate with a slightly conservative mindset, and reenactment societies are kind of a bit close to that kind of world. Do you think that's changing? Is it the world that's changing? Is it the way we think about heritage that's changing? Was it always a bad thing? Like, it's interesting, like heritage used to be quite a kind of conservative thing, and it doesn't seem to be playing out that way in some of these stories.
Yes. So, So I know what you're saying, and I am always interested in the groups that are having to face, they're going to have to change. They're going to have to do something to change, otherwise they're going to go extinct. So, for example, people that raise pigeons are really old now and young people aren't taking up the sport. And so what's going to happen? So they're all on this kind of, and you know, dog shows, most people don't get pedigrees anymore. They get like labradoodles and things like that. So what's going to happen to that? I'm fascinated by the people that are sort of on the edge of change, the groups that are on the edge of change. And reenactment societies, same as pigeon racing, there's not as many people doing it anymore. And so they need to attract more recruits. They need to recruit more recruits. And yeah, and so they're having to move with the times. I mean, your question's very funny because the diggers would have been more on the parliamentarian side. And but a lot of them were soldiers that fought for Cromwell and then were against Cromwell after he turned out to not be great. And so I joined a reenactment society, the parliamentarian side, because I thought that was where I was most likely to find the diggers. Mm-hmm. And so I turned up in a field in Northumbria with a wheelie suitcase, and they said no one normally just turns up with a wheelie suitcase. it's really rare to get a new recruit who just sort of turns up without knowing someone, without being roped into it, you know. Yes. And so they took me in and they gave me a uniform and they fed me and they helped put my tent up, and so I was like, oh, brilliant, what a lovely group of new people. And then we were all sitting around the fire and I said, I'm making a show. I always let people know, you know, I'm going to make some art. There's going to be some art out of this. The relationships I make are built on trust, and so I would never do anything to exploit that. I also don't take the mickey out of people in the show. I take the mickey out of myself, but not them. I take the mickey out of me adrift in their worlds. So I was sat around the campfire with them saying, oh, this is so exciting. I'm here to make a show. And I love making shows about Britain's hobbyists. And I'm so excited to explore the digger communities. And they said, Vic, we're royalists. And you've joined the wrong side. And but then I felt it was too awkward to leave.
Sort of weird 70s of awkwardness that was going on. Sort of
And then, you know, as I said earlier, I accept the randomness. So then I was like, okay, it's not my personal beliefs, but I'm a royalist. And so then I was speaking to the other reenactors about, because I asked them to come and put on a historical reenactment of the diggers versus the landlords in Whitehawk. And they said, we don't normally do anything political. So although we have the royalists and the parliamentarians, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have those same politics if you're on that side. We're just here because we love history and we love dressing up. And we love being a sort of specialist in the subject. So there's chefs who specialise in 17th century food. So they know exactly the ingredients that would have been around in 1649. Or you have a pikeman who is a soldier who has a large stick with a dagger on the end who would have put that, like, stabbed horses with it. That sounds horrible. But he'll know everything about all the different movements that a pikeman would have had and how they would have lived. And so they're just really interested in the history of it rather than the politics. Mm-hmm. And I have asked them, why do you do this? It's such a weird hobby. And for most of them, it's escapism. They just love, you know, they have hard jobs, whatever. And then they go and they call it a silly hobby. And then they go and dress up and they stand on a field for 4 hours pretending to be a soldier, and it's complete escapism. They also meet, you know, a group of like-minded people, and they get really drunk in the evening and play games and sing songs. And so there's a fun, really fun social aspect to it as well.
Uh-huh. It's an interesting sort of moment around some of that, because it did feel in the festival in particular, 2019, just before the pandemic happened, it was like every comedian you went to was no longer telling jokes, and every issue theatre was very kind of serious and was quite kind of bleak. Whereas maybe a moment now, I wonder whether things have got quite tough, but people are dealing with it by kind of opting into the silliness, opting into the absurdity somehow. I mean, there's a sort of warmth in that, in the air around it. It's like,
yeah, I mean, that's the only way I know how to communicate. That's the only way. And I think through humour, we can talk about more difficult subjects. This is, at its core, quite a political show, but I don't ram the politics down your throat. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's there and it's simmering and you choose to pick up on that or not.
Interesting in Edinburgh as well, because one of the issues or one of the topics that's talked about in Edinburgh quite a lot around the festival is the fact that so much of the festival happens on common good land. Whether that kind of that role is played in the festival, so interesting. I suspect there'll be all kinds of conversations are sparked by your show this year.
Oh, that's so interesting, Nick. I hadn't thought of that. That is because we completely take over the place, don't we? Not to everyone's pleasure.
Well, not so much pleasure, but also I think there's a really live issue around who gets to be on stage, which stories get to be on stage, and is the, you know, and how do we think about that? And do we design for that, or do we kind of let it be entirely open? And if it's entirely open, you know, certain voices come to the fore more, perhaps.
What are there anything in particular that you're looking forward to outside of your show in August this year?
I'm really looking forward to hanging out with Edinburgh's grassroots organisations. And what I'm really looking forward to as well is, because it's part of the DNA of this show, that wherever it goes, we connect with local grassroots organisations. And a lot of people in those organizations feel like they've got golden handcuffs. They started it because there was need, and now they can't stop it, and they're exhausted, and there's fatigue. And it's a dream of mine that I go around, connect with these people, let the audience know what I'm talking about in the show, your equivalents are blah, 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 blah. Go and get involved with them. But also, imagine if I can connect them all. You know, we can connect them all, and then, I don't know, all meet up or create some sort of space where people can let off steam about this incredible, generous gift that they're giving. So I'm looking forward to that and the potential of that, because I'm up for so long that that could become quite rich. Those relationships. And then in terms of going to see things, because I just haven't had time. I don't really know what's on. So when I get there, I'm just looking forward to spontaneously just going to see stuff and being surprised by it. I stay with a friend out in Leaf who's not a performer, and that is perfect for me because I just go and meet her after work, and then we just watch some really trash TV and just get away from the bubble, you know, and go to the sea, and so we're so lucky, aren't we? I mean, I know I was talking earlier about the financial risk, but that's going to happen anyway. So I think whilst I'm up there, just making the most of being in this incredible environment.
Superb.
Good. So that is Victoria Melody. It's a hell of a conversation, hell of a life story that wrapped up in it. For those of you who can get there and see it, it's 2:15 every day at Pleasance Courtyard. A really fascinating conversation, but also just like a fascinating way of making things, I think, that Victoria has.
Yeah.
But also, it's a fascinating way of working she's got. But I thought one of the things that was interesting towards the end, where she was kind of saying, hey, you know, maybe there's ways as the tools get better, more people can accomplish crazy things like this. Like, it's an interesting thing around how someone like that, writer, producer, you know, anthropologist, actually it's almost like like it's a very different reference, but you know, the in the American army they talk about like a one-man army. Like, now you've got all these different tools, you can achieve all these crazy things. She's not, you know, fighting a war against anybody, but she is trying to, like, it's a kind of artist hyphen activist story that I think is really powerful.
Yeah,
this year.
Yeah, sure. And like you say, she has a very optimistic viewpoint, and that's a really refreshing thing to see.
That's also another thing I think is definitely going to be in some of the findings when we draw this together. It's just a really interesting point where people are bringing really powerful stories, very serious stories, but they're leaning into the sort of positivity in it, or even the kind of, you know, I guess maybe to lead you to Diggers sort of era references, really, you know, rabble rousing in the best way, right? It's trying to motivate people to go and do a thing by being a bit positive.
Yeah.
Anyway, so as I said, 2:15 every day in the Pleasance Courtyard above. Go have a look. We will be there at some point soon as well. So we'll see how the show's going in practice. So it'll be lovely. So head over. There's loads more episodes, loads of really interesting shows. You'll pick up some of these really interesting themes that are emerging, lots of really interesting things around memory and heritage in all kinds of different places and all kinds of guises that I think this is an example of too. But loads more episodes wherever you're listening to this podcast. You can also head to labelsessions.com or any of our social handles to find out more about the project. So see you soon.
Brilliant.